This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So I'm really happy to see all of you here, ready to hear and learn about substance use disorders. This is a hot topic in our society right now, and one that I think we all have a lot to learn about, ourselves included. I do want to just put it out there that it's quite likely that there are people in the room who are in recovery. And so the things we talk about may cause strong feelings for people, maybe relief, maybe anger, maybe sadness. So I just want to let you know that it's okay to have strong feelings about what we're saying and that we're totally comfortable hearing about those and talking about those in the questions. So I'm going to start with a story about a person named Janice. Janice is born a healthy baby. Her mother is a middle school teacher. Her father has had a few different careers, but at the time of Janice's birth, he's just taken a new job in sales. She is a healthy baby. She meets all of her developmental milestones. She does really well at being a baby and a toddler. And by the time she's 2 years old, her father has lost his job. He is having difficulty finding another job. It's a tough economy. He's not interviewing so well. He is getting really frustrated, actually becomes violent in the home on occasion towards Janice's mother. So he hits her, particularly when they run out of money, and he starts to feel especially frustrated and depressed. When Janice is 5 years old, her father is arrested for driving under the influence. It's the first time that the family realizes that he may have a drinking problem. The morning in jail, he spends the night in jail. The next day, he begins to develop alcohol withdrawal. And that's when his wife, Janice's mom, realizes that he may have been drinking pretty regularly for a long time. And she starts to piece together that maybe some of this violence happened while he was under the influence. Maybe he had trouble keeping or finding a job because of his alcohol issues. And this sort of starts to fall together for the family that this may be a major issue for them. By the time Janice is 7, her parents have separated. Her mother just couldn't continue to put up with the recurrent relapses, the continued violence. And so Janice now is mostly with her mother. Her mother has custody of her. She was allowed to visit her father, but she really doesn't like visiting him. She's really angry at him for leaving. He has actually entered treatment at this point and is doing better, but the family fractures kind of remain. Janice still loves going to school. She does really well there. She has a great friend group there. She feels loved and supported and still feels really close to her mother. So I want to ask a question at this point of you. What features of Janice's life so far do you think put her at risk for developing a substance use disorder herself? So family history of substance use disorder, absolutely. That's right. That's probably one of the strongest risk factors. Yeah. So having had separated parents is a risk factor. It's common. It's not true that everybody whose parents separate develops a substance use disorder, but it does increase your risk. That's exactly right. Yeah.
If it's a broken home, there's probably risk of poverty.
Right. Okay. So because they are separated, there's risk of poverty or sort of a drop in socioeconomic status. Her mom is a teacher. Now she's a single mom. And that too is a risk factor. That's absolutely right. Yeah. I think the other big risk factor we see for her is having witnessed violence in the home. Another substantial risk factor. Is there anything that you think is protecting her right now in the story you've seen? Great. So stability in the school environment. Yeah. And at this age, it's a little bit hard to know. It'll be, I think, more predictive as she gets older. If she continues to have academic achievement and a sense that she belongs there, that can be very protective. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Father moved out.
Okay, so that her father moved out. So the influence, the violence and the substance use, that has resolved. So maybe that'll protect her rather than if it had continued. Yeah. Yeah. Ah. Okay, so her mother has showed her how to set boundaries about what she will accept and what she won't accept, what's safe for her and what's not safe for her. Yeah. So I think that that's really important. And the way we catch that in the literature when we study this and try to understand protective factors is if somebody has an adult role model, someone that they feel they can go to when they need help, that's a really protective factor. And so that seems to be her mother to some degree. Yeah. Great. Good. So yeah, we've actually now covered a lot of what I'm about to say in the next few slides, which is good. That means you already know a lot. What we're going to explore here is a model for how I understand how substance use disorders develop. And there are kind of three key features that we're going to go through. One of them is the environment that people grow up in and the environment that people live in, the environment that people experience influences their risk for developing a substance use disorder. This picture is to remind me to tell you about a study that was done actually in the 70s where they induced addiction in mice by giving them a fair bit of cocaine. And the mice developed addictive behaviors in which they would go to a lever and sort of push the lever for more cocaine and ignore the lever for food, right? They would ignore other mice around them. They wouldn't behave like normal mice. If you took those mice and then you moved them to what's called an enriched cage, which is a cage that has wheels and balls and things that mice enjoy, the mice would stop their addictive behaviors. They would return to pushing for food instead of for cocaine. They would return to playing with other mice and doing the things that healthy mice do. So this study was kind of the beginning of our starting to think about addiction as an environmentally mediated disease, something that where if you can change somebody's environment, you can change their risk of either developing it or maybe you can even treat it. Now, what we've learned, not surprisingly, is that humans are not mice. We're more complicated than that. We often carry our environment around with us, right? So if we've experienced a trauma in childhood, for example, and you just take us out of the traumatizing environment, we still carry that memory. We still carry that history. It's harder for us to just drop our old non-enriched cage, you know, move to Hawaii and have our addiction go away. So it doesn't seem to work for humans the way it works for mice, but it is a clue that our environment really is a critical part of how addiction happens. In AA, for any of you who are familiar with AA, it's called pulling a geographic when you move from one place to another in an attempt to make your addiction go away. It's understood to be not very effective for humans. But we also know that if you put people with addiction into an enriched environment, a beautiful housing, for example, you do have better outcomes. That does help. So we've talked some about what environmental factors do put people at risk. Has anybody here heard the term adverse childhood experiences? Yeah. So there's a whole literature developing right now about this set of experiences that we found predict not only substance use disorder, but depression, heart disease, early mortality. These are called adverse childhood experiences. And so what I'm going to do is list for you the adverse childhood experiences that we study regularly. And then in parentheses after them, the risk that they carry for early onset drug or alcohol use. Okay, so physical abuse, for example, increases your risk. You have 1.8 times the risk as someone who hasn't experienced physical abuse. Yeah. So physical, emotional, or sexual abuse, emotional or physical neglect are also strongly correlated. Notice that it's actually emotional neglect that seems to have more power than physical neglect in this area. Violence in the home, which we know Janice witnesses, substance use in the household, a strong risk factor, household mental illness, parental separation or divorce, which we saw in Janice's case, and then having an incarcerated household member also increases your risk. I encourage you to read about adverse childhood experiences. It's really amazing all the things that these kinds of experiences predict. And it's a message to us as clinicians that we really need to attend to these things and help and modify the risk associated with them. ACEs, as we call them, are cumulative. So if you have two ACEs, your risk goes up to 2.4. If you have four or more ACEs, it actually goes up to 6.2 times the risk of somebody who hasn't had any ACEs. Does that make sense? There's some other risk factors also that are not captured by the ACE literature. So peer substance use, strongly correlated. Drug availability and cost. So I'm going to talk to you in a little bit about early onset drug use, which is the data I'm showing you right now. The reason that I'm so focused on early onset drug use is that it's strongly, strongly correlated with the development of a substance use disorder. The earlier you use, the more likely you are to develop a disorder. So adolescents are very cost sensitive when it comes to drug use. If you drop the price of a drug, adolescent use will skyrocket. If you raise the price, adolescent use will drop. This is one of the reasons that when we talk about drug legalization, which I am in favor of, we, those of us in addiction medicine, advocate for taxing it hard so that it stays really expensive and stays out of the adolescent population. The other thing we advocate for, since I have a microphone, is that we use that tax money to support adolescent substance use treatment programs and adolescent prevention programs. Perceiving a drug to be low risk contributes to early onset use. So this is one of the reasons we think that the prescription opioids are so popular among youth, is that they're assumed to be low risk because they're prescribed. High perceived reward or high perceived normalcy. So this is part of why when your parents use in the home, it seems normal, it seems like it's fun. This is also part of why media portrayals of use influence adolescent use so substantially. Low parental supervision. You mentioned low socioeconomic status being a risk factor. Now, what's interesting about this is that it seems to be mediated primarily by access to what we call substance-free enjoyable activities. So if you take a group of youth who are of low socioeconomic status and you give them access to basketball, chess club, dance class, right, debate club, whatever it is, you give them access to those things, their risk of early onset substance use will normalize to the same as a group that is of higher socioeconomic status. Okay, so that's another intervention that we as a society can engage in to prevent this. Neighborhood residential instability. So neighborhoods where people are moving in and out, there's not a lot of stability, there's not a lot of sense of cohesion, have higher rates of early onset substance use. And again, that's why we do interventions like community gardens, neighborhood block parties, sort of trying to strengthen church groups in neighborhoods to try to develop a sense of cohesion and a sense of stability in those neighborhoods. And that has also been found to be effective. And then being of white or mixed race actually puts you at higher risk of early onset substance use. And I put this on here because we have all kinds of stereotypes about who uses and who gets into trouble, and they're actually wrong. People who are white are more likely to engage in early onset substance use and develop use disorders, particularly prescription opioid use. Protective factors we've talked about, having an adult role model, having parents who talk about the risks, engaging in enriching activities, academic achievement we talked about a little bit, and having a sense of connectedness at home or in school or in the community are all good protective factors. So let's talk about Janice a little bit more. So now she's 11, she's entered the selfie years. And she's actually continuing to do well in school, so we're starting to see that protective factor evolving. She remains angry at her father. She doesn't like to visit him. And some of her friends have started taking alcohol from their parents' liquor cabinets upon occasion. She hasn't tried any alcohol yet. She's thinking about it. She's not sure whether she wants to or not. And when I think about Janice's risk, she strikes me as high risk just because of her history. And one of the things that's particularly important for me is that family history. So we mentioned that was one of her risk factors. Just to give you a little more background, so her father, it's clear, has an alcohol use disorder. Her maternal grandmother, so father's mom, or sorry, paternal grandmother, father's mom, died at the age of 50 of liver disease from alcohol. And her husband, so her paternal grandfather, Janice's paternal grandfather, also drank heavily. He did live till the age of 70, died of heart disease, but was known in the family to be a heavy drinker. So what we're seeing is probably some genetics, in addition to the family history, the risk that she gets from having been exposed, she may have some genetic risk as well. So a question for you again. How much does her family history impact it? What percent, I'll get more specific, of her risk, or of anyone's risk, do you think is genetic? 30%, good guess. Fearless. So now we're going to talk about, we've talked about environment, we're going to talk about the person. What is it that each of us brings to alcohol or any other drug that changes the risk that's associated with that drug? And there are a few personal factors we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about genetics. We're going to talk about temperament and psychology. And we're talking about age. So it turns out that substance use disorders are highly heritable. So 50 to 60% of your risk for developing an alcohol use disorder comes from your genetics. This is based on twin studies, right, where you take twins who are adopted by different families, and you see to what extent that disease tracks along genetics. Very strong genetic correlation. For other substance use disorders, depending on the study you look at, it's 45 to 80% heritable. Really strong genetic component, which I think points to the biologic mechanism here. It's not just your environment. There's different biology for people. Temperament also plays into it. So people are born with particular temperaments, right? People who have higher degrees of impulsivity, hyperactivity, and novelty seeking are at higher risk of developing a substance use disorder. And then age. So this is a really important one. And this slide is a little bit hard to understand. If you haven't looked at a million Kaplan-Meier curves, this is called a Kaplan-Meier curve. It's the name of this kind of graph. So what they did in this study was they took thousands of people, followed them for a long, long time, and looked to see what proportion of them continue to not have alcohol dependence after the first time they tried it. So, for people who started drinking over the age of 21, the vast majority of them lived their whole lives without developing alcohol dependence. Does that make sense? Not many drop off the curve. For people who start drinking before the age of 14, about 45, 50% of them will develop an alcohol use disorder at some point in their life. Huge, huge correlation between age of onset and developing the disease. So I think, personally, I think of substance use disorder and alcohol use disorder as a pediatric disease. The risks start in childhood. The first symptom usually develops right here, before the age of 14, actually, maybe in mid-adolescence. And then the sequelae, the side effects, all the issues come in adulthood, but it really starts here. 9 out of 10 people with a substance use disorder started before the age of 18. And one of the reasons I hammer on this is because I think it helps us understand a little bit that this really is biological. The adolescent brain hasn't developed to the degree to be able to handle this stuff necessarily. And partly because I think it really reduces our stigma around this. It's very hard for me to blame the 12-year-old for having tried this for the first time and gotten caught up in it. And it helps me be a little bit more compassionate about the pickle that people get stuck in. Let's talk about Janice again. So now she's 12. She's at a party, and a friend offers her a beer, and she tries it. And it makes her feel energized. It makes her feel relaxed. It makes her feel like she can just be herself in a way that she really hasn't felt before. She starts seeking out parties where alcohol is available. It's not hard to find them. Over time, she also begins raiding her mom's liquor cabinet, having some drinks on her own sometimes. She also deliberately seeks out friendships with people who can buy her alcohol, and that's also pretty easy to find. And at the age of 13, she tries Vicodin for the first time and finds that that's even more pleasant than the alcohol was, even more helps her just kind of relax into herself in a way that feels good. Her grades start to falter. Her mom doesn't know what's wrong. Her mom tries to get her to think about her future and what those grades mean and how important it is. And they start getting into fights because Janice doesn't want to hear it. She starts dating someone who sells opioids in the school. And her Vicodin use increases steadily over time. And by the age of 16, she's decided she wants to move out of her mom's house and in with her boyfriend. So Janice has a lot of environmental risk factors. She's got some personal risk factors, particularly the genetics. And then she gets exposed to the drug. And that's really the third ingredient for developing a substance use disorder. And unfortunately, she gets exposed to her first drug, alcohol, very early. So we're going to talk a little bit now about drugs, the different drugs, just really quickly, and then how they impact the brain. What is it about these drugs that leads to addiction? So the first thing I just want to say is that drugs have really different drugs have different risk profiles. And it's not, I think, fair to clump them all into one category necessarily. This is a graph that shows what percent of people in the U.S. have tried a particular drug and what percent of those develop, or what percent of people then go on to develop an addiction. Some of these data are from 1999. So, for example, the tobacco data, I think, are old. I think we're doing better now. But just it gives you a sense of, you know, if 76% of the population had tried tobacco and 24% of the population had developed an addiction, that's actually a very addictive substance. And we don't give it credit for being as addictive as it is. Whereas something like cocaine, marijuana have lower sort of trial to addiction translation rates. Okay. But what all these drugs have in common is they lead to a release of dopamine in an important part of the brain called the nucleus accumbens. So this is the reward and drive center of the brain. This is the part of the brain where when you see something pleasant or experience something pleasant, you get a dopamine release. You watch a beautiful sunrise, you get a dopamine release. You eat a delicious chocolate chip cookie, you get a dopamine release. That's what the nucleus accumbens is there to tell you to keep doing that thing. Go have another meal. Right? Go flirt with that person with whom you're going to, you know, propagate the species eventually, right? That's what the nucleus accumbens is for, is to drive you to do things that help us survive as a species. The problem is that drugs cause a huge burst of dopamine at that center and hijack that natural reward system that we have. The other thing that we see in people with substance use disorder is, in addition to increased activity here in the nucleus accumbens, we see increased activity here in the hippocampus, which is associated with learning. So you drive in these intense memories about how good the substance use was in the hippocampus. If you talk to people about their first time using heroin, you can often get extraordinary detail about an event that occurred 30 years ago. What the weather was like, what they were wearing, who they were with. The kind of detail that gets laid in for these events is impressive. And that's the hippocampus firing, again, with a lot of dopamine with every exposure. The other thing we see is reduced activity in the orbitofrontal cortex and the prefrontal cortex. So these are the parts of the brain associated with what we call executive function or self-control or impulse control. So this part of your brain says, yum, more please. And this part of your brain says, no, it's time to go to bed. Right? This is your self-control center. We see reduced activity and even reduced development if people start using young of this part of the brain, and increased activity and increased development here. Right? So the way that I think about it is if one of you has a delicious looking chocolate chip cookie sitting in front of you and I am hungry, my nucleus accumbens says, that looks good. And my hippocampus says, I remember the last chocolate chip cookie you ate. It was delicious. And my nucleus accumbens says, let's do it. And I start reaching and my prefrontal cortex says, Diana, that's not your cookie. Stop. Back off. They will think you're crazy if you take the cookie. And so I don't take the cookie because I have a pretty active prefrontal cortex. That's how I got through medical school. It's true. Okay. So just to give you a sense of how strong these drugs are, this is if you take a mouse brain, you put a sensor in the nucleus accumbens to sense how much dopamine is being released in the nucleus accumbens. This is a mouse just hanging out, being a mouse. You put food in its box and whoop, its dopamine level goes up by about 50%. You take a male mouse, you put a female mouse in the cage and whoop, the dopamine level goes up by about doubles. You give the mouse methamphetamine and its dopamine level goes up to 10 times what it was previously. So the amount of reward we're talking about is massive compared to natural rewards. And that's how these drugs can hijack our reward systems. Okay. So that's our model, right? There are environmental factors that influence people's risk. There are personal factors that influence people's risk. And then you put them in contact with a drug that impacts the brain circuitry and leads to addiction. I'll tell you a little bit more about Janice. So she's now working as a store clerk, but she's starting to run short on money. So she steals something from the store and loses her job. She's finding it difficult to avoid the prescription pills that she's been buying on the street. They're actually quite expensive. Costs about $1 a milligram for prescription opioids on the street. And what people typically do when they can't afford their prescription opioids is they switch over to the cheaper option. Anyone know what the cheaper option is? Yeah, it's heroin. Yeah. So she switches over to heroin, and she is miserable. She's miserable. She misses the life she had. She misses her home. She misses her mom. She thinks all the time about the future she could have had. She knows things could have been different. She goes into withdrawal multiple times a day. So heroin only lasts a few hours, and then she has to go and find more. And she hates the things she has to do to get more. She hasn't talked with her mom in over a year. She cut things off with her friends when they started guilt-tripping her about the fact that she was injecting. And she's been in the hospital a few times for infections in her muscles because of injecting, although she does try to be very careful and use clean needles whenever possible. It's not always possible. To prevent HIV. Yeah.
So the question is, does Janice have a substance use disorder? Raise your hand if you think the answer is yes. Yeah, you're like, that's why we came here tonight. So she does have a substance use disorder, and I'm going to talk about how we diagnose that as doctors, nurse practitioners, PAs, health providers. And I want to be really clear that the diagnosis of a substance use disorder has nothing to do with use of needles. So there's a lot of thought and bias that, well, if a person uses a needle, you know, that's addiction, right? Or these are sort of stereotypes in our mind of what constitutes addiction. And the reality is that to make a diagnosis of a substance use disorder, it's what we call a clinical diagnosis. So clinical diagnosis means that I don't send a blood test. I don't do an MRI of a person's nucleus accumbens to diagnose a substance use disorder. I take a history. I do a physical exam. I learn about what's going on in the person's life, and especially their history and interaction with the substance. And I sort of put that composite together to determine if they have a substance use disorder. And our guide for that is called the DSM-5. It's the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual that was developed by psychiatry. And this is the 5th edition, and it's like a book like this big. There are actually 12 different factors that go into the diagnosis of a use disorder, but I've sort of arranged them according to this mnemonic, and I use it for my teaching with residents and medical students because it's actually really difficult to remember 12 things in your mind and ask the patient about each of those things. Essentially what you are looking for is, the 4 R's, the 4 C's, and then withdrawal and tolerance. So have they risked bodily harm? Are they having relationship problems? Role failure. So that means, right, we all have roles in society, right? Roles to be, mothers or, fathers or sisters or brothers, roles to be students, roles to be, workers, roles to be parents. So the inability to sort of fulfill those basic social roles is a sign of loss of control, especially with regard to a substance. And then repeated attempts to cut back, right? So that cognitive dissonance. And we also sometimes say that substance use is ego dystonic. So you don't want to be doing it, but you do it. Right? So that in its core shows you sort of the loss of control that comes with substance use. The 4 C's, so the loss of control. If you only remember one of these things, it's really the loss of control. That's sort of the signature. Inability to control your finances, to control your relationships, to control your future. You know, and we see that in our loved ones, and that's often when we know that something's going on. And then the rest, you can read there. So how many do you think Janice has? So risk of bodily harm. Yeah, she has that one. Relationship trouble, right? She has no relationship with her mother right now. Role failure, right? I think we didn't hear if she's working, but the fact that we didn't hear stands to reason that she's not. Repeated attempts to cut back. Diana didn't describe that specifically, but that's something that you would sort of hear from her. We know she's having withdrawal. We know she's having compulsive use, right? So spending time and energy to get a substance. And then continued use despite harm. So, you know, she actually has what I would call a severe substance use disorder. Really want to spend some time thinking about language. So, DSM-5, I told you that's what we use to make the diagnosis. In DSM-5, everything is called a substance use disorder. DSM-4, the predecessor version, use the diagnostic terms substance abuse and substance dependency. And very intentionally, DSM-5 has changed the terminology to use disorder because this is incredibly stigmatizing language, right? When I say abuse to you, I don't think that conjures images of like serenity, you know, peace, well-being, right? It conjures images of domestic violence, violent situations, just really negative things. So when we refer to patients as substance abusers, that's incredibly stigmatizing. And it's that years and years of that treatment of those individuals is why there's incredible mistrust of medical providers. And then also it adds to sort of policy making, right? Why we may not fund programs or create supports for people with substance use disorders. So another sort of key pearl I'm hoping for tonight is that we all sort of change our language and change the language that we see our peers and friends use. You know, so I do that too, and I say, yeah, you know, actually it's kind of interesting. We don't use the term substance abuse anymore. It's kind of like a fun fact to really share with people. So encourage you to do that. I wish I could tell you that that doctors are really good at diagnosing chemical use disorders, but we're not. So there's actually been studies where at hospitalized patients where people with substance use disorders are overrepresented, probably because with a substance use disorder, you have a loss of control and you tend to have medical, physical consequences that put you in the hospital. And so that should really be the place where we're looking for it and diagnosing it and taking that good history and meeting all those DSM criteria. But we only pick it up about 2/3 of the time, right? So we miss it 1/3 of the time. And then in the clinic, we do this even worse. And that's because, we tend to screen people, based on what we think they do or the ways we think they act, as opposed to using universal screening. So the United States Preventive Services Task Force, which makes recommendations on mammograms for screening and right what we need to do to keep everybody healthy, they have made recommendations right that we universally screen every person for alcohol and drug use disorders. And so you should all pay attention next time you go see your provider whether they screen you, right? And then, you know, so the question is sort of how common substance use disorders. We call this, you know, sort of the pyramid or the spectrum of alcohol use. So by far, the greatest burden of addiction really comes from alcohol use disorders in the United States. If this is sort of the population, the majority are abstinent of alcohol use or have low risk use. Low risk use for a man is less than 4 or less drinks in a day and less than 14 drinks in a week. Those are safe limits. For women, it's 7 drinks in a week and 3 in a day. So that's the majority of people at the bottom of the pyramid. Then there's a swath that have problem drinking or risky use. And then the top of the pyramid are individuals with alcohol use disorders. So about 8 to 9% of the population has an alcohol use disorder. So this is extremely common, probably in all of our families here today. And then 20% with risky use. And then determining, you know, what the prevalence of other substance use disorders. This is from the National Survey on Drug Use and Health. The federal government has created this survey to have a sense of how common substance use disorders. It's actually a telephone-based survey, a random sample call to individuals that are housed in order to, and then this is basically asking last month use of substances. And so you see last month use of binge alcohol use. That's the blue bar. And then the red bar is sort of illicit drugs. So 10% of Americans in the past month have used illicit drugs. That doesn't mean 10% of Americans have an illicit drug use disorder. But this gives you a sense, just as Diane alluded to, drug use is, it's common, right? Not everybody has a use disorder, though. That's what we call that clinical diagnosis. There's lots of research showing that as doctors, we are we treat our patients differently if they have a substance use disorder. So there's different ways you can study that. For example, if a person has hepatitis C and there's a person who inject drugs, this is a relatively old study, but 81% of doctors would not offer treatment to a person that injects drugs. One of my jobs is purposely to treat people that are actively injecting drugs because we know that that's actually a key to eradicating hepatitis C. But you know, so that means that like most doctors say, like I'm not gonna treat that patient, right? So it's like a value judgment, you know. This was like a study showing that if you were a doctor and you were treating a person who happened to inject drugs, you were less likely to offer them antiretroviral therapy for their HIV, right? Because the assumption is that, you know, you wouldn't want treatment or you can't take treatment or, right, just really sort of negative assumptions about what an individual can or cannot do. And then this was a study of, they talked to patients and they asked how they felt when they entered the healthcare system. Hospitals like the ones that Diana Scott and I work at, 60% of the time people felt that they were treated unfairly. Half of the time they felt that people were afraid of them. And then 45% also carried this notion of feeling like their families had given up on them. So it's just an extremely vulnerable population. I think it's really easy to sort of dehumanize them and just see them as drug users, you know. But they're persons, you know. They're members of our family, and they're subjected to an incredible amount of prejudice and ill will. Again, I think we all, just the fact that you're here tonight is, makes you an agent of change in terms of, battling this, uphill battle against stigma. So thank you for being here. The final thing, this was, a study that was actually done in a while back. I see some younger people in the audience. This was looking at, attitudes of medical students compared to residents. So medical students are like just in school, and then residents, you know, have started their process to become a doctor, and then house staff are like first, second, or third year residents. And so bigger scores means you have a more negative attitude towards a person with a substance use disorder. And so they ask them questions in these domains like character weakness, prognosis, nature of disease, and every year you go along in training, your attitudes get more negative towards individuals with substance use disorder. So this is part of my job, is combating like the cynicism and the burnout in the trainees that I work with. And so I think that this is really getting better. But it's, again, it requires us to all be purposeful. This was a nice recent editorial in the New England Journal of Medicine. It was written by an infectious disease specialist. And she said, at some point, it became culturally acceptable to treat all conditions in a patient except addiction. It's a diagnosis still frequently and falsely regarded as untreatable, a convenient assumption driven by the stigma against people with this disease. And she was sort of taking a stand about the fact that, like, I don't just give antibiotics, right? I need to treat the substance use disorder that this person has, that's also part of why they have the infection that's requiring the antibiotics, right? This whole person care and treating substance use disorders like a chronic disease, just like diabetes or hypertension. We also know Scott will probably allude to this, but right, the relapse rates in diabetes are the same as what they are in substance use disorder. So right, all chronic illnesses have periods of times where they are better or worse controlled. So again, I thought this was just a nice quote to sort of summarize how we all have to become frontline addiction medicine providers. I'm going to bring you guys back to Janice. She really wants to stop using. Everybody, I actually work one day per week in the methadone drug treatment program, and the people I see too, they want to, every day they want to stop using, right? So it's not a pleasant feeling. She really is hoping to actually be a journalist, and she wants to write. And she's tried to quit on her own, but it hasn't worked. And so she tries to just go to her mom's house and says, I'm just going to get out of the environment, right? And I'm going to quit cold turkey. I'm going to detox myself. She makes it through withdrawal. But then her, and she actually has not used for 2 weeks, staying with her mom, right? So it's like this sort of beautiful moment. And then her ex-boyfriend calls her again. And then she relapses. So this is sort of a lot of where I spend my time, is in this circle with patients. And we think of people sort of pre-contemplating whether they want to stop using a substance, and then contemplating it, right? Like really getting into purposeful action about change. And then actually making the preparations, right? So what did Janice do? Janice said, I'm going to move in with my mom, right? I'm going to go to a drug-free environment. And she did that. And then she actually was abstinent, but then sort of returned to use because of a trigger. So the nice part about the circle is that you can get back onto the circle, right? So that's what I see all the day, every day, is people sort of entering this process again, having the courage to re-enter the process and try again to cut back and to stop using completely in cases. Scott's going to come up now. He's going to talk more about treating substance use disorders.
So we're going to talk about treating addiction, all addictions, in 20 minutes. All right. And the truth of the matter is that treating any addiction, treating any substance use disorder, will probably be, you'll be doing better than what we do right now in this country, because in the Surgeon General's report in 2016, the number that he cited was that only 10% of people in this country with a substance use disorder are receiving treatment for their disease. Why is that? Well, you've heard, I think, a big chunk of it, and it's because that there is a stigma against the disease, like, and people who have the disease. But what I would like you to consider is something that probably some of you are already thinking. It's like, substance use disorder, people who are in their addiction aren't pleasant to be around, right? The behaviors that define the disease are really profoundly antisocial. And so that leads to this disconnect from society at large, as well as contributing to this stigma. So those behaviors, you know, contribute to the stigma that's part of the problem. So that's sort of number two, that make it so that patients and providers just don't want to talk about it. And then the third part is the part that quotation sort of alluded to, which is that we act like we don't know what to do with people who use drugs when they don't want treatment right this second, like they have to fail. So we're going to go back to this model and operate on this model to come up with treatments for patients. And the first one we'll touch on is the environment. And so you change the color of the environment, you change the environment, then hopefully the drug use falls away and you enter recovery. And so that's sort of the model that is predominantly used in the United States, quote unquote, detox and rehab. This is a beautiful facility in the Bay Area that you can pay $60,000 for a month of treatment at. And the idea that it is, that substance use disorder or addiction is something that you can, quote unquote, cure with an acute treatment is very appealing to everyone, right? The person who's suffering from the disease, their family, etc. So that's one way to attempt to treat, is through this environmental cure. The problem is that we can't just hang out on that porch and sip lemonade for the rest of our lives, and so it doesn't necessarily work that well. The other place that we really focus our change of environment on in this country is by incarcerating people with substance use disorder, dramatically overrepresented in the population, in the incarcerated population, and that's our, you know, how we treat substance use disorder. And so you might get the picture that I am saying, like, oh, you know, environmental factors, not a great way to treat addiction. But the truth is that Janice really does need fellowship and social connection. And she needs loving or at least non-judgmental acceptance to reconnect with people. And it's often easier to find that among people who have already been through a similar circumstance. So she's fractured her relationships with her family in the past. Oftentimes people have fraught relationships even with friends. And they've been harmed by how she behaves, you know, when she was addicted. And so people aren't used to having positive interactions with their doctors. And so, you know, many, many years ago, many of these peer support programs were developed. I'm personally aware of the power of 12-step rooms and have They've been very helpful in helping support many people, not just patients, whom I love and respect. But I don't necessarily push them on my patients. I don't refer people to 12-step programs. Instead, I kind of offer them this menu. And these are four different locally available options, and we'll talk about three of them here and one in just a minute. Alcoholics Anonymous, very easy to achieve, and you wouldn't be surprised to know that in San Francisco it's very tech-friendly and savvy and tells you where the next available meeting is and whether it's open to you or not. It's very handy. SMART Recovery stands for Self-Management for Addiction Recovery Training. It's really practical and can be used by folks remotely as well as in person. I have a lot of patients who have really cottoned onto this because they didn't like the quote-unquote God talk that is prevalent in many rooms, 12-step meetings. And then Refuge Recovery is a Buddhist-based system. I encourage you to check it out. The other piece, of course, that drives our choice of treatment is what substance somebody is using. So if you can knock out that drug use, again, try to achieve some recovery. And, you know, I'm a doc, so I like to prescribe, you know, medications or treatments. So there's that. So it really depends on the kind of drug that the person's using. So the main point here is going to be to know that if somebody has opioid use disorder, which is what Janice has, or one of the substance use disorders that she has, she needs a medicine. Now, you might say, well, she's already proven that. She's failed, you know, her trials of abstinence on her own. But I'm here to tell you that that's true for well over 95% of the populace. People who have an opioid use disorder need maintenance treatment, full stop. Abstinence only in this setting works about as well as it does for preventing teen pregnancy. Actually, worse than preventing teen pregnancy, because abstinence only leads to increased risk of death. Naltrexone is a very attractive option because it makes you not feel opioids. It's a blocker. Unfortunately, it is not habit-forming. You're not physically dependent upon it, right? If you miss a dose of it, no big deal. And that makes it not work very well, except in very specific settings. So you have to be highly, highly monitored. So it's still up there. It's FDA approved, but not as useful. Methadone maintenance and buprenorphine maintenance are very effective in helping people restore their lives, become, you know, so-called productive members of society. And they get there by reducing their opioid use. These are the four legal ones in this country, but in people who fail those treatments in other parts of the world, there are other options, including diacetylmorphine maintenance. That's heroin, right? Given at the clinic and somebody comes in and injects it under the supervision of healthcare workers, or hydromorphone, which is brand name is Dilaudid. Those are not yet legal in this country, but, there is, active efforts to organize a randomized controlled trial for those medication modalities in this country. There's zero reason to think that it won't work here. She also has an alcohol use disorder. I'm just guessing based upon her early use. We didn't go through the criteria, but there are plenty of medications that help prevent return to drinking. People think that there aren't meds, but in fact there are. Both to maintain abstinence and, let's say that somebody wants to drink less but isn't quite ready to give it all the way up, there are options for that as well. Many people are very familiar that there are medications to treat tobacco use disorder, nicotine use disorder, that work really well. And people don't get as hung up on the patches or the gum or the lozenges as they tend to do with methadone or buprenorphine when they say that it's just a substitution. In fact, it works really well to reduce risks attendant to ongoing nicotine use. Medications don't work as well in substance use disorder when they are stimulants. And by stimulants, I mean amphetamines and cocaine. These medications, these are just a small part of the kinds of medications that we have tried. Usually they're effective in a single center, and then they turn out not to be effective at all. So, depends on the drug, depends on the environment. What about the person, right? Can we do anything to modify her genetic predisposition? Because if we could do that, you know, then we can let the brain circuitry heal and she goes into recovery. Sadly, there's not currently any generic therapy for addiction. We can change her potentially some other way, right? We could vaccinate her against it. So there's active research in immunotherapy for alcohol use disorder and cocaine use disorder in particular. And the idea would be, right, you give somebody a shot, and then your body produces antibodies to that chemical, and then it gobbles it up before it has a chance to go into your brain, right? So far, those trials have not been successful once implemented beyond phase one, but people are actively looking for that. So that leads to the question, what if we could go just straight into the brain? What if we could just rewire the brain directly and not rely upon sort of time and nature and abstinence to do this, right? Like, what if we could just get right in there and do it? That would take care of the drug, it would change the environment, and lead to recovery, right? So this is a thing. Interventional psychiatry or neuropsychiatry, almost like a return to the beginning of the turn of the 20th century, is a thing. So this is a picture from a lab in Stanford where they have a training program even. And the idea is that they have implants where they will put stuff into the parts of the brain that modulate these behaviors. Or in this case, it's actually magnets on the outside of the head that sort of help rewire the brain. Not quite ready for prime time, but you're here, so we'll give you the cutting edge stuff. The thing that I would say is that we actually know how to rewire the brain. It's called learning. So there's really easy ways to do it, and then there's more challenging ways. The easiest way to do it is called contingency management. And contingency management is the most effective treatment for stimulant use disorder. So amphetamine, cocaine, et cetera. And you don't need any fancy devices or surgeries. You just need to reward people for not using cocaine. Okay, they kind of figure out how to avoid the cocaine on their own. But if they come in and they produce a urine sample that doesn't have cocaine in it, you give them a reward. And it doesn't even have to be that fancy. But the simplest way to think about it is, okay, you turned in, you're new to treatment. You know, you've turned in a positive cocaine multiple times. Now we're going to try and work with you and try to make this better. You turn in a negative urine for cocaine. Here's a dollar. You come back 1 week later, you do the same thing. Oh, that's 2 weeks in a row. Here's $3. That's the simplest way to think about it. But it turns out, and even that works, okay? Even that works. But it turns out that if you do that on a variable schedule, kind of like gambling, right, it works even better. So you give somebody a one ball in the raffle machine or one ticket to the raffle if they've turned in one negative urine. You give them 5 tickets if they have turned in 2. You give them 10 tickets if they've turned in 3 in a row. And for prizes that range from a $10 gift certificate to Safeway to a brand new fancy TV, and people do what they need to do to not use. It's pretty amazing. Rewires the brain. In addition, cognitive behavioral therapy, whether it's delivered by a trained therapist or even app-based or manual-based, works as well to reduce drinking. And finally, researchers have demonstrated changes in the brain associated with mindfulness training and so so-called mindfulness-based relapse prevention coursework is something that I've offered to many patients. But Scott, you're saying you guys haven't said anything about anybody's personal responsibility. You know, you're saying that, oh, it's all this environmental cues and the genetics, et cetera. But where's the agency for the person? Like, if I have a substance use disorder, I want to know that I can do something to change my behavior, right? It's kind of disrespecting the person not to include individual agency in this. So I've included this little motivation box in here. You know, sometimes when it gets bad, when it gets really, really bad, Janice could be super duper motivated and it's very, very high. Her motivation's high and she really wants to overcome it. You know, to paraphrase the late Philip Seymour Hoffman, who died from this disease, addiction is doing the one thing in the world you most want not to do over and over again. But you know what? This is not a willpower thing, even though I really wish it was. And sometimes, on the other hand, people aren't motivated at all to quit. Think about your own in your own life in terms of any behavior change. There are times when you don't feel like going for that run. And so maybe, or maybe they don't even know how. So what do we offer people in that situation? There's a term that gets thrown around a lot called harm reduction that means a lot of things to a lot of people. I would start by talking about things that you know about. So probably the most dangerous thing that anybody in this room did today was get in a car. Except for maybe Diana who rode her bike. So, you put on a helmet when you ride a bike because it's risky and it's a little bit less risky if I wear a helmet. I put on my seatbelt when I was in the cab on the way over here. It's a little less risky if I have a seatbelt on. If I have too much to drink, I take a cab. People smoke less than they do in an effort to try to reduce their risk of harm. These are all things that you can imagine. For our patients who are injecting drugs, having access to safe needles reduces their risk of developing infectious disease, and giving them naloxone or Narcan, the antidote to opioid overdose, saves lives because it keeps people alive long enough to hopefully enter treatment. So one of the things, and the reason that we were late getting here, is that one of the things for our most vulnerable patients, people who are living on the streets and addicted to injection drugs, is that they don't have a place to safely inject. And this is an intervention this is a picture of an intervention that would help with that. So this is a supervised injection facility. This is the first one in North America. It's called Insight, and it is in Vancouver. It's been open since 2003. You can kind of see how it works. These are booths where individuals can come. They bring in drugs that they've purchased off of the street or from friends, whatever, and they inject. This is a mirror. That's why it looks like there's two sharps containers, and you're looking at it from the point of view of the healthcare provider who's sitting here and looking at all these folks, making sure they're safe. And if people aren't doing well with finding a vein, they'll come and help with that. If they overdose, which has happened thousands and thousands of times at this facility, they can go and make sure that their oxygen level stays healthy, and if necessary, provide the antidote. They've had zero fatal overdoses, zero, in 14 years of operation. Harm reduction also saves money. I'm not going to go into detail, but this is something that would save San Francisco County money as well. This is an intervention in Seattle where the people who were costing the emergency room the most were people who were alcohol use disordered, picked up off the street. You have seen them sleeping it off. They would get run to the emergency room regularly. They were costing the county $4,000 per person per month after they were put in a facility where they could drink. And nobody, it was a big room, and they could sleep there. That came down 1 year later. That was a quarter of what they were costing the county. And so, you know, what are those, all those interventions have in common? You know, we put this up there as to kind of, you know, bait you a little bit. And, this is not Janice, right? This is her substance use disorder. And so what do all these interventions have in common? It's that we remember that Janice is still Janice, even if she's got an addiction, and even if she has a substance use disorder. And so when somebody is doing something that is part of a disease that's hurting themselves, they're still that person, and they deserve the same love and respect as they did when they were a small child. So my message to you is that you can do something about that. You heard about using person-first language. You can tell loved ones that treatment is available and effective for substance use disorder, and you can support harm reduction in your neighborhood, city, state, and nation. The last one seems sort of obvious, like people who are vulnerable need healthcare coverage so that they can treat these things. There was actually, as you probably know, a bill in front of the California, this close to being on Jerry Brown's desk earlier this year, that would allow safe injection sites in several counties in California, failed by two votes in the Senate after passing the Assembly. One of those people was a pediatrician, which is pretty disappointing from a physician perspective. But he was one of four abstentions. And so there are four people that probably are movable on this. Regardless of whether California goes through with it, San Francisco has in front of it the possibility to act on their own. And if you have a supervisor who seems to be waffling on the issue and you're interested, you should probably talk to them about it and find out why they feel that way. The organization of the task force was a unanimous decision by the Board of Supervisors to make this a possibility. And so the task force came back with recommendations to try to have several different sites in places where people are using drugs in public so that they no longer have to use the drugs in public and can have access to services more readily. And that came out just 3 weeks ago on October 20th. We were at a meeting with the Health Commission, and it sounded like from the commissioners that they were universally positive as well in endorsing this. And then it's going to be down to the Board of Supes to really make a determination on what to do about it. But I think that we have tried to leave lots of time for questions about this, about the etiology or the way that substance use disorders develop. How do we define it? How do we treat it? We tried to leave lots of time because I'm guessing that people will have opinions and questions and all of that stuff. So I'm going to open it up and invite my colleagues to come back up. Yeah, from a treatment perspective, we've tried that, right? I mean, tough love is what manifests in, you know, Bill Graham, walking in front of Bill Graham at night. I mean, I don't recommend it, but you will see, I assure you, plenty of people who are recipients of that treatment. And those people are at higher risk of dying, higher risk of contracting disease, and less likely to come to see me for treatment. So if it worked, I might be in favor of it, but it just unfortunately does not, and then puts people at higher risk because it just reinforces the stigma, keeps them separate from family, friends, etc.
Yeah, I will just add one thing. I think that's right, that the amount of shame and self-loathing that's associated with addiction is, I think, hard to imagine if you haven't experienced it, and really inhibits people from receiving care. I do think the place where tough love starts to feel more attractive is when you're a family member who feels like you're just being destroyed by your loved one's addiction, right? So people do need to figure out how to set boundaries that keep them safe. So for example, you may not be able to let somebody with an addiction live in your home because they may, you know, steal things so that they can buy. So there are places where people have to set boundaries, but I always think of that boundary setting as in service of being able to continue to love the person. So that I can be here for you, I need you to live somewhere else. You know, it's hard.
That's the National Survey on Drug Use and Health. And it asks about last month use. And that was sort of binge alcohol use. And then last month use of illicit drugs. So 10%, if you call a random sample, right, if we all got called right now, 10% of us would say that we use some illicit drug, you know, cocaine, heroin, whatever. Okay. So the, as Diana's saying, right, the majority of those people are probably marijuana. So that's not the percentage of the population that has a substance use disorder. Most common, so about 8 to 9% of Americans have an alcohol use disorder. But in terms of an opioid use disorder, it's like 0.5 to maybe 1%. The raw number of persons that have a addictive disorder to heroin is like, it's like 500 to 700,000 people, right? And our population is 300 million ish, right? So there's so much, right? You know, it's like, you know, if somebody says addict, you know, you imagine the needle, right? Or you, when that's actually a really small number of people. So much more common are, you know, use disorders with alcohol, and then estimates for tobacco, about, this has gone down. Used to be that about 20% of Americans smoke cigarettes, but, San Francisco, it's 11%. We're ahead of other places. So, any extended family has somebody with, a use disorder, and the answer to that is probably yes. And again, sort of the failure of diagnosis or the difficulty of diagnosis. So you have to really ask people personal questions as a clinician. And with so much self-loathing, like Diana alluded to, you can see how somebody might not report accurately to their healthcare provider, especially if they feel like they're being judged. You know, I get care at Kaiser, and you know, they say, so you're exercising 4 times a week. And I say, yeah. I mean, but like, you know, cause like, if I say no, then they're going to judge me, you know? So, and that's how a lot of screening for alcohol is, like you don't drink, do you? Or right. Like you don't inject drugs, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so that's a value judgment, right? You know? And so that's where, so anyway, hopefully that gives you a sense of the numbers.
Yeah. I know that I sort of slagged on residential treatment, or at least rehab, earlier. So the question is about, when people have multiple substance use disorders, how does that complicate things? It very much complicates it, is the short answer. And a lot of times people need a little bit of intensive medical care to be supervised as they withdraw from those substances. Okay? That's the biggest thing in the acute phase. But recall that it's a chronic disease. And so then it also complicates your choice of agent in how you're going to treat that person going forward. So, you know, if you're lucky enough to live in a place where you can enroll somebody in a contingency management program for their stimulant use disorder, you can do that and enroll them in my clinic for methadone maintenance if they have an opioid use disorder. And while they're there, you know, I will give them a pill for their alcohol use disorder, you know, but that's kind of, as it sounds complicated, the stars really have to align for that to work out. And so it's really tricky, would be the short answer. And it really, what we find in treatment is you get somebody in treatment for one thing, and that substance that was a, you know, not a problem, all of a sudden is a problem, and then that complicates their treatment as well. So yeah, multiple substances involved on board really gets tricky.
Yeah. So the comment is that it was striking to hear that there's this substantial risk in such young people, sixth grade to ninth grade, kind of being this critical period. And it is shocking. It's scary for those of us who have children, and sad, I think. And I think points to a place that we really can do a lot of good. That's a period where we can intervene effectively. And I don't think we give it quite enough attention. So, and then your other was a question about what are the safe drinking limits? And then we might add the question, how did those get defined? So you're going to write them up here. So for men and women, they are different. And the age, that's true. We didn't talk about age. So for men, we say you can have up to 14 drinks in a week, or 4 drinks in a sitting. And the way that those numbers are actually derived is by looking at large, large scale data. So we look at kind of population level data and see what kinds of health outcomes are associated with different levels of drinking. And what we find is for men who drink more than 14 drinks in a week, they are more likely to have liver disease. They're more likely to have some cancers. They're more likely to die of these kind of chronic effects. And men who drink more than 4 drinks in a sitting, any time in the last year, actually, are more likely to have car accidents, be involved in assaults, those kinds of things. For women, the cutoffs are 7 drinks in a week and 3 drinks in a sitting. That 7 drinks in a week reflects the fact that women metabolize alcohol very differently. We're much more likely to develop liver disease with less alcohol, so we're more vulnerable. Then, over the age of 65... you get the women's cutoff, no matter your sex. And then we say pregnant people or people on medications that don't mix with alcohol, none. Those are the standard limits.
Anything else you want to add?
Sorry to be the bearer of bad news on that one.
It's interesting to point out that we have no daily limits for cocaine use. That's because it's really hard to actually study illegal drugs. I don't know why I'm using quotations because they actually are illegal, but but it's very difficult to study illicit substances. But for alcohol, we actually have data to support these numbers. And a standard drink is a 12-ounce beer, 5 ounces of wine, 1.5 ounces of liquor.
In the state of California, it's actually better to be on Medi-Cal. Is the short answer to that. It covers everything. You have to get so far into your addiction or start out so poor that you qualify for Medi-Cal. So that is covered without a prior authorization, without any special anything. Same thing with methadone. It's covered by Medi-Cal. Private insurance depends on the plan. And there's actually the California Society of Addiction Medicine rated all of the covered California plans and private plans, and you can check that out at the CSAM website to figure out which ones are better and worse. But for those opioid use disorder treatments, that's the issue. For all of the other pharmacotherapies, it really just depends on your prescription drug plan, and as long as it's FDA approved, it's very easy to get covered. Most of the other medications that I listed up there are also a generic, so they're pretty inexpensive and often covered. So the question is, all the other ancillary services that are required to treat somebody with a substance use disorder, we all work in the safety net, so we all rely, and I really want to applaud you for bringing this up, because that was an omission on our part. If it weren't for the people who I just called ancillary services, I wouldn't have a clinic, you know, at my opiate treatment program. So we have counselors, we have social workers, who are some of them social workers. We have nurses who watch people as they get their medication. We have people who are administrators. You know, we have all kinds of things that have to happen. And in any treatment program, the boots on the ground, as it were, are largely nurses and social work.
It's worth mentioning, in San Francisco, if you are poor, we have one inpatient, we have one detoxification facility where you can receive medication to bring you off of a substance, right? So that's important for alcohol and for opioids. So we have one place, it's in Hayes Valley, and it has a total of 20 male beds and 6 or 8 female beds for the whole city of San Francisco. So, right, there are the places that Scott showed that's where you pay the $60,000 a month. But if you think about, again, people really afflicted with this disease, often because of that loss of control, do not have substantial assets. And so, as a safety net, we don't really have lots of detoxification facilities for individuals. So there's always work to be done.
I think the thing that is actually most effective is exposing people to people in recovery, right? So having like a panel of people talking about their process of recovery, what it was like to get through, that is really helpful. So they do that at UCSF in the medical school, right?
You organize it.
Scott organizes. I don't know why I'm talking. You can talk more about it. We also have the medical students go to an AA meeting to experience that. And then buprenorphine, which only became available 15 years ago or so for us to start using, and really has only taken off as a treatment for opioid use disorder probably in the last 10 years. That has really changed the game for a lot of people because it gives you an opportunity to help somebody. And one thing that clinicians hate is not being able to help people. I think that's where a lot of the stigma comes from, actually. Like, I couldn't help you, we'll forget you, right? But now we have something we can do to help. It really changes people's attitude towards the disease. And being able to just see somebody getting better, I think, is probably the most powerful thing we have.
It must be also said that part of the reason for that change is also racially and ethnically motivated. So once it became more common to see, I mean, if you look at the hotspots of where overdoses are happening, at approximately 10 overdose deaths are happening about 10 times more often than they are on a per capita basis in San Francisco, where heroin's been around forever, like West Virginia, Kentucky, etc. White folk of middle class or upper middle class extraction are dying. And so that's led to this, oh, addiction's a disease, not a thing to incarcerate people for. That's been a big thing. And so knowing somebody that has the problem. The other thing that we try to do with stigma is language is fundamental. And that's why she brought it up. If you present highly trained, this has been done, highly trained psychology and psychiatry, mental health providers with a case, and you use words like abuse, and you use pejorative language, and then you show that to a large subset of them at, say, a convention where this was done. And then you show another subset of them the same case, but using the kind of language, person first language, that we were using here tonight. People are more likely to have a positive attitude about that patient, the same kind of data that you saw earlier as well, if they're a person who got, if they received the person first language. If they got the, you know, this person was in jail, I said person, they said they're a junkie, they have these other, you know, pejorative language, even just IV drug user instead of person who injects drugs, that's when they have a negative attitude and are less likely to recommend treatment. So what, it seems really corny and sort of like unbelievable, but language frames how you envision somebody, and how you put names on things really does matter in this. It has life and death consequences. That's a very complicated question. It depends, is the short answer. Methadone and buprenorphine, the main thing is it maintains your tolerance. So if you and you don't need to use, meaning you don't get withdrawal symptoms if you take it. It'd be like, let's pretend that the drug that I am physically dependent upon, caffeine, had negative consequences instead of the health protective effects that I hope it does. it is financially draining. It's true. But let's pretend that the consequences were worse than I'm irritable and get a headache, right? Let's pretend that it was, I feel like I'm going to die, even if I'm not going to die. Then I might go steal something to sell to then go pay my $5 for a cup of coffee or something that I did today. Does that make sense? So in order to eliminate that, you give a medication that lasts longer, right? That does not involve the risks associated with injection. And you provide that In a controlled manner. So my nurses actually watch the person take the medicine. So that's that version. All those other things work on much different levels. They're much more complicated, and I don't think it'd be appropriate to go into all of that. But that's the fundamental of the opioid treatment.
I just want to make one last plug. If you do want to hear patient voices, there's a great book called Beautiful Boy. And the companion book is called Tweak. It's written by a father of in the Bay Area here, a father of a boy who had a addiction to speed, and then his son wrote the companion novel, which is called Tweak, and they're both incredible. So,
and the movie's coming out in February. Yeah, so read the book first. So thank you all so much for taking the time to be with us today. And we will stick around. We're available to answer questions afterwards. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.